Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. Show number 8, Haiku. Being in the moment, flowing with the seasons. This is your host, Monk, and ironically, there's a lot to talk about haiku, which is the shortest poetic form. Of course, I'm gonna try to be concise, because that's what haiku teaches us. Haiku is almost a wordless art. It's about getting the fewest words to say the most. So it's a minimalist art, similar to other Japanese arts, like the Zen gardens, which have maybe a rock or two, and it's all sand, the Ikebana flower arranging, which is a few flowers, but the precision in which they are arranged is of utmost importance. And it's a very self-effacing art. It's almost the opposite of the hip-hop scene and a lot of poetry that is about this oneself and where one grew up and came from and gone to. That said, some of the classic masters, even in haiku, talk about themselves. So one of the big things in haiku is that there really are no absolutes, but there are some guidelines. I try not to make it sound like a class, but I do actually teach haiku classes and workshops. And a little ding there. That's I do often begin the class with the singing bowl, so we'll start with that. As I was saying, I'm gonna try to make it free flowing and not too much like a class, but I do want to give an overview of some of the background, a little bit of historical information, the cultural, philosophical context, and basically a few pointers for how to write them and some of the basic structure. And meanwhile, giving some examples, because usually that's the best way to show what a haiku is really about. So here's a little Tibetan bowl ding to begin. On the topic, say, of compassion, one could talk for an hour and explain, and of course there's a lot to learn and much that is important. And yet, there's the haiku from Issa, Kobayashi Issa, one of the considered one of the five haiku masters. And it goes like this. Don't worry, spiders. I keep house casually. Don't worry, spiders. I keep house casually. So there you have a good example of how haiku says something without saying a whole lot. And one of the reasons most haiku poets will repeat the haiku twice is because, well, they are so short, and sometimes it flies over the head. So try to repeat them and read them a little differently rather than reading it with the exact same cadence. A basic overview for haiku that I like to present is that it's talking on, and they're speaking on three different levels, or you can approach it on three different levels. You could pick one, or you could pick two, or all three. Those three are the hobby, the literary genre, and the way of life, which some call the haikai no michi, which is probably the deepest level, definitely the deepest level. It is really making haiku becomes a part of one's life, and oftentimes integrated with a spiritual practice. Basho, one of the masters, he studied Zen Buddhism. Yisa was a Pure Land Buddhist. Chio Ni also was a nun in a Buddhist temple. So there is that flavor of that tradition of journeying as, in a way, a haiku poet. Basho traveled around and recorded in his journal, Narrow Road to the Interior, his haiku and stories. So that is probably the best reflection of the haiku way of life. Now, the literary genre has to do with learning some of the technique, some of the rules, which we'll get into. And that is more towards just knowing the form, and also if you want to be submitting to magazines and this and that, some may have, you know, some of the editors may be form editors, and so they're going to go by the form. Some have more leeway, it depends, but that is knowing the tradition and having a respect for the tradition that I think even helps, even if you're not going to take it that seriously, it still helps with your haiku. And then there's a hobby. By hobby, I mean, because it's such a short form, it's easy to write. It's easy to write them pretty good. It's hard to write really good ones. But you can dabble. You can put them in your journal. You can put them on a note card and send to somebody. So there's a hobby sense, which a lot of people get into, that they don't care so much about the exact technique or the form or the rules, but they just want to have fun with it. Which isn't to say that haiku isn't fun, but it just depends on the level you want to get into it. And in that case, the hobby is, you're not really so concerned with how, quote, good a haiku is. You could write, you know, got up this summer morning, had breakfast, what a beautiful day, which in essence is a haiku, but it's, how much it's a good one is debatable, but it's, you could go on, the point is you could do, you know, you could crank out 50 of those little descriptions, and in a sense, you would minimize or demean what a real haiku is. But again, as a hobby, that's fine. So I'm trying to talk on all levels, as some people may have a little bit different interest than other people. In communicating with a native friend the other day, he mentioned the indigenous way of tuning into the Mother Earth energies and going along and abiding with that, and the nature beings, and how that works. And I think that connects with a lot of the Eastern philosophy and practice, and also with the haiku, because haiku is one of the key factors is that they have what's called a kigo, K-I-G-O, a season word, which indicates what kind of season it is. And this affinity for the natural world also shows up in how they're written. Chio Ni, who was a female haiku master, she was in a Buddhist temple for a while, and she has a very Zen type of haiku, which goes like this. Clear water, no front, no back. Clear water, no front, no back. Now, recently I had heard a Native American describing someone how the English language is awkward. If you were to say, "Hey, he's standing in front of that tree," we, you know, English American speaking people know what that means, but to a native perspective, when you think about it from the tree's perspective, there is no front of a tree. So, there again, you have the water, no front, no back, a tree, there's a circular dimension. So, this is the kind of way that haiku is has a lot of depth and insight, and along with the Zen koans, they have that flavor to them. And they try to get at something much deeper and to enlighten us and enhance our experience. But not all haiku are like that. There are two schools, in a way, of haiku in modern worlds. A lot of people feel that it is definitely an offshoot of the Zen practice, whereas others don't. So, again, there's no absolute. I find that the striving for a Zen-like quality does give an added flavor and depth to the haiku, but sometimes they are a simple nature description. Sometimes to some people they're boring or too simple, but they are beautiful nonetheless. The wind, the breeze is blowing, so you're hearing a little. If you're hearing a little chime, that's become a natural background noise. Now here's one by Busan, who was another of the haiku masters, classic Japanese masters. Morning breeze riffling the caterpillar's hair. Morning breeze riffling the caterpillar's hair. Now that is more of the simple description. Haiku is often like a telephoto lens. It focuses on something small and magnifies it, the caterpillar's hair and the morning breeze. It's a simple moment, a feeling. Different than the kind of Zen depth of the no front, no back of water. So it really depends on your taste of what pleases you when you read one. Now there's an excellent book. There's so many books. When I started reading and really getting into haiku, I started collecting books and people started giving me books. So the collection's up to over 50 now. But that said, I'll probably say that a lot today. That said, you don't need to read anything really to know or write a good haiku. Someone I know hikes a lot, and he had never written a book of haiku, and he has some beautiful haiku. Some of the first ones that I wrote, I think I probably won't do as good. And in a way, I've improved, but yet some of the first ones were probably some of my best. So it's really to say that the books and studying haiku can help you learn about it, and definitely refine your skill, but it's not a necessity for writing good haiku. One excellent is by Robert Haas, The Essential Haiku, Versions of Basho, Busan, and Issa. And he has some notes in it, and he explains some of that level of haiku. Haikai is what it's originally called. Haikai was something you did, not simply a means of production of text or the text themselves. One engaged in haikai through a personal relationship with haikai's past as embodied in one's teacher. You joined a group or groups, and while book study was an important part of your integration into haikai, much of the learning and enjoyment took place in the face-to-face interaction with your teacher and fellow poets. Shop owner, priest, samurai, actor, wealthy farmer, or petty bureaucrat, the poet was provided with a vantage point on the old poetry and a style growing from it, contingent upon his teacher and haikai ancestry. You belong to all that, and it to you, and what's more, the government could neither tax it nor take it away. Several centuries of the manufacture of haikai were sustained and propelled by two byproducts that were, for many poets, probably more important than what appeared concretely on the page: wit and pleasure. Well, this is Mark Morris describing an essay on Busan in the book by Robert Haas. It does connect with the sense of the East Indian music tradition of a guru and a teacher. And originally, the haiku poets would gather together. Master would write one poem for the season, and then everybody else would follow along and add to it. So it became a linked verse, almost like a forerunner of email, how we network and communicate with each other. And that was called Haikai no Renga. So the modern haiku today was actually plucked from that opening verse, and that's how we know the individual haiku. And it has become a worldwide tradition, written in many languages, many countries. I've seen the Native American haiku, Europe especially. Richard Wright, the black author, he's written some. There are many haiku poets around the world. It is national. Global. There's haiku foundations. There's a lot you can get into to explore. One of the things about the Kigo is that the season word is used to identify the season. And oftentimes it's obvious, like spring rain or winter moon, but sometimes it is very subtle. So if you have a cherry blossom mentioned, you know that's a sign of spring. So you wouldn't say in spring when the cherry blossoms bloom. That's being redundant in the haiku language. And sometimes it can be very specific. It really helps to be aware. It's helped me be a better gardener in a sense, because I'm very aware, and that helps my haiku poetry. Being aware of the exact day when a flower blooms or a plant blooms or a bird is back in town, those kinds of things. So it's a form of the way of life. It really sharpens observation and awareness. And you can actually keep journal. Sometimes I go back to my old haiku or journal to say, oh yeah, it was May 5th that the Oriole arrived a few years ago, so I got to start looking for him. So that's one way. Now, Robert Frost has an interesting thing about haiku, the season word, which again ties into the indigenous and shamanistic perspective. My personal theory, not especially well informed, about Kigo is that their origin is shamanic, animist, and ritualistic. That the words for winter blast and spring blossoms and summer shower were intended at one time to call forth the living spirits manifested in those natural phenomena. American poets began to take an interest in haiku around the time at which they became interested in the translation of Native American songs, and the similarity between them was often noted. I think the reason is that they bear the traces of a similar function. The Chippewa hunter's song soliciting the spirit of the deer is not very different from the Japanese poet soliciting the spirit of the cherry blossoms. The shaman's songs passed into folk songs. The folk songs provided the basis for a courtly poetic tradition on the one hand, and for a Buddhist poetic tradition on the other. In the courtly tradition, the traditional symbols of the seasons became psychological ways of expressing states of desire. That goes on, and they became instruments of Buddhist meditation on the reality and unreality of the phenomenal world. And in that culture, they became the basis, as Morris said, for a calendar of festivals, a liturgy of the season that told people both high and low how they were at home in the world and what powers they moved among. Basho has called attention to this process, and here's another of his haiku. The beginning of art, a rice planting song in the back country. The beginning of art, a rice planting song in the back country. And Haas says, the word I've translated art is furyu, and it also means elegance, refinement, and calls to mind specifically the manners of the court. So that's another tricky thing with haiku, is the translation. You can read various translations, and some are better than others, so it's tricky. But the gist of what he's saying is that it really, the season word is a connecting to the natural world, and that is part of the reason, one of the reasons for my love of the haiku. I feel like it's a way to help us connect with the natural world in a world that has gotten very urbanized and concrete, roadways and such like. Another wonderful book is The Haiku Handbook, How to Write, Share, and Teach Haiku by William J. Higginson with Penny Harder. Higginson passed away, I think, a year or two ago. He was very revered in the haiku community and is missed. And at the end of this book, he gives category, a listing, encyclopedic listing of the season words. Now, obviously, with climate change and different parts of the world, the season word it doesn't sort of hold up. But in essence, from the Japanese tradition, the season words are really, it's like a code language, and it's hard to replicate that in an English American haiku. But it's a guideline to look at it. But in the traditional Japanese, they have categories in each season, such as season and climate, astronomy, geography, observances, livelihood and life, animals, plants, and such like. So I think there are, last time I counted, there were 15, 25 different words used for cherry blossom. Could be first cherry, mountain cherry, double cherry, falling cherry blossoms, cherry blossom viewing, and it's almost like how many words Eskimo have for snow. So the level of precision is quite fascinating and poetic in its own sense. The cloud peaks or billowing clouds, evening shower, rainbow, lightning, these are some of the season words for astronomy in the summer. So there's a whole scientific level to this from the traditional Japanese, and they have, as far as I know, everybody in Japan writes haiku. It's almost, it's just part of the culture. They have rocks on pathways that, with famous haiku by Basho, so if you're hiking along and you come across one, and I try to think of what in America there is that it unifies, that everybody does, and, well, I thought of TV, but that's not really a active action. I guess the best I could come up with is gardening. But as far as a cultural art, I think that's a great role model that Japan has for us. The haiku really, in a way, unifies the country on a literary level. That was some thunder in the background, and maybe you heard that. These are the kind of moments, I call it the lie detector in reverse, where the day is just going along, and you can see the little thingy on the paper, and all of a sudden there's a big, large blip. That is often a haiku moment, something that stirs, that emotes, that you take note of. Just it's something different. So here I am talking and blabbing, and all of a sudden I hear boom, 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 the thunder in the background, and that to me becomes the potential for a haiku. Quietly talking, startled by thunder. Summer afternoon, something like that. Sometimes they come out right away, and other times they take a little while to edit. Another technical point is what's called a cutting word or a pause. The kirije, K-I-R-E-J-I. Now, in the Isa haiku that I read at the beginning, "Don't worry, spiders, I keep house casually." Right after spiders would be the kirije or pause. That's where you wonder what's going to happen. "Don't worry, spiders, I keep house casually." It's usually after the first or the second line, and occasionally it's not in there, but it is a good thing. It helps to keep the haiku from being a sentence. Now, let's see. Another factor of haiku is the... It really is, in a way, opposite of what we learn in school as far as grammar. It's very fragmented. It's often not the typical subject, object, and articles are difficult, like the and a. You really have to question that. And now, one of the biggest myths, which even a few times that I've been into elementary schools, and pretty much the first thing I have to say is the 5-7-5. Now, almost all modern haiku poets agree that 5-7-5 is not necessary. It's really just a guideline. The optimal number of syllables would be about 9 to 12 in English. But again, it's flexible. Sometimes they can be 19, and sometimes they can be, 2 or 5. Whatever works for the haiku is the guideline. One of my favorite short ones is by local poet Ginger Williams. "After a long journey, cooking pots cold." after a long journey cooking pots, cold. Now this is only, I don't know, last time I counted, 9, 10, 11 syllables, but it tells a whole story. She's come home from the journey, and she notices the cooking pots are cold, and, you know, who knows whether she's about to cook, but there's a before, and there's the haiku moment, and there's the after. It's a whole story left to the reader to kind of imagine, and that's only with a few words. So that's really what one of the things the haiku strives for. And whoo, that just sent a chill towards me. The crack of thunder. The thunder beings liked that. They agree with that. The 575 myth comes from the Japanese, is from ancient Chinese, a picture language. They do not have regular syllables. They have sound symbols. And in their language, 575 is the correspondence. But translating to English, again, it comes out, someone did a study, typically a little bit shorter, so more like 9 to 12. Again, it's just a guideline. Now, the short line, typically first, the little bit longer line, and then a short line is, again, the 575 guideline, but again, it really depends on the poem. Sometimes the first line can be really long, or the bottom line really long. Some people are innovative and do one long line. Some people do four or five lines. So there's a lot of modern experimentation, but generally the basic form is three lines with a short, a little bit longer, and short again. Now, a book that I published is called Haiku One Breaths, A Voice Through a Tangle. It's an anthology of poetry from a variety of poets. Many of my own poems in there. And also a basic overview that I'm talking about here, and a bunch of tips about how to write. So it's a good little pocket-sized book you fit in your pocket, carry around with you. And that's available on my website page. And the name One Breaths comes from, why are haikus so short? And because originally they were meant to be uttered in one breath, something you could utter in one breath, like "Hello, how are you today? Take care." That's sort of like a conversational haiku moment. And then, looking at the old pictographs, translating that, it had to do with a vine and a mouth, and so that's where I came up with the a voice through a tangle. And oftentimes haiku are that. I like to compare them to a bird call, where you're doing something, all of a sudden you hear a crow, or rah, 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 or some bird that just stops you in your tracks. And that's much of what a haiku is about. It really catches you, and makes you pause. Another favorite of mine is an autumn one by Basho. "This road, no one goes down it. Autumn evening," or another translation, "Along this road goes no one, autumn eve." Now, again, the translation, sometimes words like the road or the way or the path, that can be have that Zen or Taoist flavor to it. And speaking of such, R.H. Blythe has considered the classic overview. It's a 4-volume collection on haiku. It's a wonderful book, although I don't always agree or much care for a lot of his interpretations, but he does organize the haiku by season, and especially the first one is about the Eastern culture and shows the flavors of haiku, which he gives in a chart what has fed haiku, and that is essentially the roots are in Indian Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Taoist philosophy, Confucius, Zen, Chinese poetry, Chinese art, Japanese art, and all of these branch towards the haiku. So again, there's a big tradition and all that behind it, which you can get into, or you can just get into more of the fun of it, and both of those do merge. Blythe lists Zen as it is related to the mind of the haiku poet with 13 headings: selflessness, loneliness, which is more aloneness, you know, having to just like a monk being by oneself and that experience. Grateful acceptance, sense of contentment. Wordlessness, oftentimes people who meditate come out of a meditation with maybe just an image or a phrase, and that's what haiku is about too. It's a few words out of the sort of wordless void. Non-intellectuality, it tends to go right, cut through the thinking, so you don't want to be abstract. Sometime a woman sent me a haiku once that was it was a mother holding a child, and it had sort of that mother holding child warm fuzzy feeling, and I responded, well, nice image, but not so great on the haiku. And she responded back with something along the lines of, you know, mother holding child, one heartbeat against the other, or large heartbeat, small heartbeat. Now that was it. That hit it for me, because I could, even though not being a mother, you know, holding a child, not knowing what that is like literally, I could experience the heartbeats and see the image and feel the two heartbeats. So that gave me the experience. So the abstractions are again shunned, and that's why it's said to be concrete poetry and non-intellectual. Another great example of the non-intellectual and non-judgmental, which is the key as in Taoist philosophy. This is by Busan. His Holiness the Abbot is shitting in the withered fields. His Holiness the Abbot is shitting in the withered fields. Now at first you might go, oh my gosh, how is he talking about the abbot that way? But hey, you know, everybody, we're all human, and it's a function we all must do. So it's really a non-judgmental, simple description, and if you have a reaction to it, that it teaches you where some of your stuff is, in my opinion. Contradictoriness is another quality, that sort of blending of opposites. I had mentioned Allen Ginsberg's sunyata, connecting the lightning rod, connecting the void in the Zen talk, and that's a Issa haiku. It's been a good day, let another fly come on the rice. It's been a good day, let another fly come on the rice. All right, the other qualities: humor, freedom, non-morality, simplicity, materiality, meaning the you know, dealing with concrete in the physical world and not avoiding abstraction, love, and courage. Well, usually in the classes, people ask questions, and then I like to respond on them. So here I'm kind of just forging ahead and going to kind of check over some notes and sum it up, because I realize I could go on and may do another talk on this, or a series for those who are really into the haiku. Some are political. Some are political, that's right. Not that many, but there's a classic sort of pro-peace, anti-war poem by Basho. Summer grasses, all that's left of imperial soldiers' dreams. Summer grasses, all that's left of imperial soldiers' dreams. I think I'm quoting that close to exact. So Basho gives you the long-range view. Jack Kerouac did a lot to promote haiku in the West, and he called them pops. That was his nickname. They have that zing to them. And I like to categorize them as aha moments or ah moments. Some are smooth and gentle, like the wind ruffling the caterpillar's hair, and some are aha! You know, no water, no front, no back. It's like, when you get that, it's like, wow, never thought about water that way. So, again, there's that zen quality. Basho lived in the 1600s, is kind of considered the Shakespeare of haiku. And that's when haiku really began to flourish, even though the roots go back 2600 or so years because of the Taoist-Buddhist connection. A lot of haiku, in a Zen way, is what's left when you don't notice everything else. Everything, sort of take away the extraneous, and that's what's there. One morning I stepped out on the patio, and there was a thick fog, and the forsythia was blooming. It was bright yellow, and the haiku, the moment just got me, and it became this poem: steam, fog, dawn, the yellow forsythia, everything else gone. Steam, fog, dawn, the yellow forsythia, everything else gone. Because at that moment, that's what it felt like, that the whole world was just that image. And again, it's like trying to convey the wordless experience into a few words. A couple of technical things. Each year, All Book Books publishes a haiku calendar, which has 30 to 50 poets and artists. And that'll be coming out soon. If you're interested in a copy, you can email me. That's up on the website. And I also send out an email. It's a free email. It's called Haiku du Jour. It's every day an email plucked from books and classical Japanese poets and American and people I know and my work. And started sending that, 8 or 10 years ago. And without really trying to promote it, there's now, 100, 120, 150 people on the list. So it has an organic nature to it. And it's just evolved that way. And it shows how adaptable the haiku is, because it's perfect for people's cell phones and gadgets, the short form. A lot of people don't have patience for some long poetry, but they can still get into the haiku. All right, well, as you can tell, there's a lot more that could be said, but that's a good overview. I do want to add that there is an art form called haiga, which is H-A-I-G-A, which is combining art and haiku. Some people use their photo albums and write their haiku. Some people actually do calligraphy with the art. There is haibun, H-A-I-B-U-N, which is a journal or travel narrative in prose, which typically is punctuated by a haiku. And there is senryu, which is a humorous form of haiku, often poignant. It has a humanistic quality. It's the same as haiku, but it tends to focus on the human condition more so than the nature condition. It's hard to pin it down sometimes, and they do overlap. Cor van den Heuvel, who put together the haiku anthology that helped put modern haiku on the map, he says that, two things that I remember hearing him that are quote-worthy. He says, with haiku, you write half the poem. So you really want to give the reader a tidbit. You want to sort of step out of the picture and allow the reader to experience, or the listener to experience what you experienced. And the other one is that he said, haiku are poems that record a moment of awareness or keen perception of something in the natural world that somehow relates nature as a whole with human nature. Poems that record a moment of awareness or keen perception of something in the natural world somehow relating nature as a whole with human nature. So again, it's very holistic, and it connects us with the natural world. And senryu record a moment of keen perception in the world of human actions, which reveal something about human nature itself. A teacher, a haiku poet that I know, Bill Zavatsky, this would be a senryu. He wrote, guy with no left hand working for the airline seems happy enough. Guy with no left hand working for the airline, there would be your pause, seems happy enough. So there is no nature reference, and it has a poignancy to it. A lot of times they're funny, but this one isn't. But it teaches us about, hey, this guy's content with his, even though he's missing a hand. And so there's a lot of depth to it. And I'll take a quick look at notes and see if there's anything else I just want to throw in at the moment. Some of the people I mentioned in the Zen talk, Taiego, the Korean Zen master, and Soen Nakagawa Roshi, the Japanese Zen master, they were very much into haiku, and having just read one or a few of their poems, I could tell by the quality of their haiku that these guys knew or experienced something deeper, so that got me further into the haiku. So again, even though it's a minimalist art, it says a lot. It'll help you with your writing, even if you don't write haiku, to help you be concise and precise. Sometimes when talking with people, and I realize I have to be concise, in my head I say, okay, go into haiku mode and try to say it. The word keeps coming to my mind, concise, terse, as precise as you can say it. Alrighty, thank you for listening again, and thanks for the emails. Please do email if you're listening and want to let me know that you're enjoying the show, or if you have a suggestion for a topic. I'd be glad to see if I can work that in some week. Next week is going to be continue the poetic theme, and then it's going to shift, I think. Next week's going to be sound, sense, and nonsense. There's a classic book of poems that I remember from probably elementary school called Sound and Sense. But the nonsense part that I'm adding to that is how some poetry, the sound that words makes, just is so stirring on a level that is beyond just knowing what it actually means. It's something just touches deeply, and that is a prime motivator for the art of poetry. So that'll be next week. And this week we're going to go out with a little bit of the singing bowl and the wind chime hanging from the ceiling. So thank you very much for listening. And if you do want to dabble with some haiku and you want to email them to me, I'll be glad to take a look at them. So take care and have a good one.